Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's lovely to see so many people here this afternoon for one of the highlights of the season, the President's display. Well, it would be most inappropriate for me to introduce our President to you and tell all various details about the background. So just a quick thing to say, several months ago, John said, I talked about his 5 o'clock and he said, well, when I give the 5 o'clock, it'll be a little bit controversial. But when I spoke to him today, he said, not so much controversial, more provocative. Now, over to our President. Let's see what he means by provocative. John.
Well, the first thing I want to say today, I hope is not provocative. I've got a small announcement to make. Probably should be keeping it for the AGM, but I thought the fellows and members here present might like to know that we exchanged on the freehold of this building and the other two buildings yesterday, and we are now the proud owners of our own properties. It didn't cost very much, as we had a 900-year lease, but it did take 2 years to get there. Right, well, now, the first thing I want to say about today's display is that the material in the frames is almost entirely not mine. The stamps and the letters here are Her Majesty the Queen's, and Ian Gregg has taken quite a bit of his time to prepare to remount some of it and to bring it here and to look after it. And I'm very grateful for the permission we received and for you doing that, Ian. The letters at the far end are out of the Society's own archives. And they're quite interesting, but you don't have to try and read them in the original because the handout actually has got a full transcript of these letters and those, which are all relevant to these stamps. The two frames of covers round the corner are my own minor contribution because they're really quite basic as far as this material goes, but I thought I'd better try and put something up. Now, the first question is, why did a postal historian get into a six-year study of a lot of peculiar stamps? And I suppose the reason is really because Jack Ince and I, 15 years ago, wrote a book on the Niger region, and somebody in the expert committee thought that probably we knew something about the stamps as a result and sent us some to expertise, or me. And as I knew absolutely nothing about them, I thought I'd better try and find out. So I've worked hard through the archives here, the photographs in the expert committee, the BPA's records, the Philatelic Foundation, other American expert committee's records, all the sale catalogues, and then I put a note in the LP expecting no real response, and over 20 people have sent me material from around the world to add to the archive. I've seen two collections entirely, this one and one that has been hidden away for some 25 years, and I have got photographic reproductions of other collections, but I haven't actually seen the stamps. So that's the sort of background. And I'm very grateful not only to Ian and indeed to Michael Seffi for the permission that I was given and the help I was given, both to see the stamps and to reproduce them, but also to Mark and John Taylor for their clients' help and these other various people I've already mentioned. Now, it is important that you can today undertake research on a subject that you don't actually own yourself. Scanning and the internet open up a whole vista that didn't previously exist. So, a serious subject, and I strongly recommend to other people who may be wondering what to do with their philatelic time, you can do it even if you haven't got it, but you've got to be a bit determined to get all the evidence. I've got box files of 4,700 individual stamps. Now, why did they take place? Well, the first thing is that the Niger coast and the delta is here. And we didn't have much control over that. But the first British move towards that was signing local treaties in 1884. Unpaid merchant acted as consuls in each of the ports. And from the 1st of January, there was a consul in each of those red ports, but the ones we're primarily concerned with are El Calabar, Bonny, and then some usage at Opobo and the various other places, Fort Cardos, a little bit in other places too. Now, from the 1st of January 1891, the sphere of control was extended and it changed its name. They kept changing the name, this time to the Protectorate of the Oil Rivers and adjoining native territories, and they put a consul general at El Calabar, which is, as I say, there, and there were vice consuls appointed formally for the other ports. Then in 1893, the territory, the British were very good at this, it extended indefinitely into the interior and was renamed the Niger Coast Protectorate. There are a number of people who are quite crucial to the whole research and the exercise, and there's a dramatis personae on the back of those notes and a fuller one in the supplement, so I won't go all the way through that and tell you again about the people. Now, although the British Treasury had granted permission for the use of British stamps in Lagos and foreign ports on this part of West Africa as early as 1858. Strangely, there are no reported cases of use in the Oil Rivers before the 30th of August 1892, and that was after the GB stamps, most of which you can see here with the Oil Rivers Protectorate overprint, had actually been issued. In fact, they'd been issued a month and a half before. So why British stamps were actually needed at all is rather unclear. I've seen 34 instances of these unoverprinted stamps used in that period and a few later. I suppose it's a mystery, but it's not today's real study. We now come to the provisional surcharges, and I'd just like to say a few words about how one can identify 4,700 individual stamps. The first thing is that the actual surcharge moves around. You can see here that the P is lined up with the L, and here it's right over the O, and the bar moves, and of course the letters are pretty crudely printed and they all look different. So that's one way. The second thing is, and this is a bit more subtle, but the British Protectorate Oil Rivers overprint moves as well. You can see there it's right against the left margin. Here it's much further over. Thirdly, and this again is getting a bit more subtle, but the stamp actually moves around, or the perforations which took place after the printing move around, and the corners particularly will help you identify, but you can see that the centering of the stamp is a little different. And then, of course, I don't really have to say that when they're used, the postmarks are all too clearly different. Now, the first shortage of halfpenny stamps arose at Old Calabar, and it was in September 1893. This is well reported, and there probably was a need for new or extra halfpenny surcharges, and indeed probably for the penny ones later. But there were a lot of philatelists involved even out on the coast at the time. There was a gentleman called Griffith who was not only a philatelist but one with extremely strong views, and some of them not correct. He was a vice consul at El Calabar. There was another vice consul, Tanner, who kept plenty of stamps for himself. He says so, but the snails ate them. So we do know that all the stamps that were surcharged do not still exist. Now, there's Mr. Perryman, and he writes, and you'll see his letters here, he says, "I've got my man buying up the stock. He can get all the stock he can get and has his ear to the ground for any information available from the vice consuls." And they, of course, were acting as postal agents, so they would know. And then there's Claude MacDonald, later Sir Claude, who was either the ambassador or the senior official in Peking at the time of the Peking siege, the siege of Peking. So he became rather more well-known later. But he knew enough about stamps to keep one of the 20 shillings, black one, which is here, and he writes about it, and he writes to his friend Lucas, to whom he'd supplied it. Mr. Lucas was not only a collector, but he was a dealer. He worked for Whitfield King. And he says to Mr. Lucas, if you want it if you want it cancelled, send it back to me. I've asked the postmaster to do it very nicely. Well, he didn't anyway. He kept it as it was. But later, he sold it in 1920 to one of the Mr. Harmers, who secretly was buying up for the king. So it wound up in this collection. And that is a bigger picture of the stamp. It's all over the place here, but I think the 20 shillings are fascinating, and I'll come back to them. The initial shortage in September to which I've referred was the one in which there were two halfpenny stamps surcharged on a penny like that, and they're to be found in the first frame. Now, this was followed by a big issue, the much bigger issue, where halfpenny stamps were surcharged on both tuppence and tuppence halfpenny stamps with so-called trial sheets and bulk production at Old Calabar. And it's always been assumed, all the writings in the past have said, that the fancy sheets with mixed colours and inverted, sideways, diagonal and diagonal inverted surcharges were produced first. Frankly, I'm pretty sure they weren't. About 100% of them exist, if the reported quantities that were produced were anywhere near accurate, and I would conclude that they were made for officials to give or sell to collectors, although they were supposed to have been sold over the post office counter. I can only say that if there was a real shortage, the first priority should have been to produce and sell stamps for actual use. Now, let's consider the bulk production. Those are copies of each of the ones on the tuppence value, and they were said by Perriman and repeated by Porter to have been three sheets with violet surcharges and half a sheet in blue. Dick Agerbeg, writing in the 50s, agreed with this, and out of all these people, he was the only one I met, but probably there are one or two people in the room who will remember Porter as well. I've seen more than enough for there to have been four sheets in violet, and even that would have meant that all the stamps said to have been produced would still survive now, including every single one that had been used. I would reckon there are plenty for room for forgeries too. Now, I asked one or two of my more experienced friends, what percentage of a real stamp really produced for usage would you expect still to exist? And I've heard 5% or 10%. Now, when you come on to the tuppence halfpenny value, and those are the bulk stamps there, lots of nice varieties, but nonetheless all produced in reasonable bulk, Perriman, Dawn and Porter agreed 14 and a half sheets in all. Agerbeg reckoned there was a sheet less, but most of his calculations were based on what he'd actually been shown. And of course, you know, he could have had a camera, but he wasn't getting scans and internet stuff sent from all over the world. So he could only see and record what he'd actually seen. And to count stamps that you haven't got photographs of is virtually impossible. They lump certain stamps together, and the grouping goes back to Perriman's original letter, which is over there, and the early Gibbons catalogue listings. These are set out in the supplement so that you can follow how the changes took place. Were again all of every, or at least nearly every typeface and colour to have survived, including the used stamps, there would have had to have been more or less of a number of them, and those two are set out in the supplement, but I won't go through the detail now. For me, the big question is, why are there so many still in existence? If you take the higher estimates of quantity produced, there are still 87% of them still around. That's taking the ones that have got good certificates and that have not been submitted for certification, but which, to me, look okay. If you take the lower estimate, there are 93% of them. So I can only say there are an awful lot of stamps around that shouldn't be. Now, let's go on and consider the black surcharge and the blue-black one here. They've been regularly described as part of the rare stamps, the trial sheets. The first thing I noticed about them, looking at the actual stamps, was that, and looking at colour photographs, which are less reliable, that there isn't really any trace of blue in any of them. And as far as I'm concerned, I believe that there are heavier inking and lighter inking, but they're all basically black. Now, just to complicate things further, there are three settings of this surcharge. 75% of the singles have got the H lined up over the space between the P and the E. There are five singles with the left stroke of the H over the right loop of the P there, and there are 10 with the H aligned over the E. Of the normal stamps, that's the ones on the left, which are some are heavier inked and some lighter, there are 44 singles that I've identified, and that's not the ones in the multiples, which clearly came from the mixed colour sheets, the trials. There are 44, which would be nearly a half sheet. And I think it is probably more appropriate to reassess these as one of the smaller quantities produced in the bulk production. I also don't think that if they'd all come out of these fancy trial sheets, as many as 44 would have been cut into single stamps. I think there would have been many more in the multiple colours. Going on to the so-called trials, there are 19 different stamps on tuppence with exotic surcharges over 9 varieties. Those are some of them there. On the tuppence halfpenny, there are rare stamps, and these are examples of those. They range from a single stamp having 2 examples up to 18. But they're all in much smaller quantities than half a sheet. And then there are also 60 exotic surcharges over 18 different basic stamps, and these are illustrated examples of them in these frames here. So there are lots of different things. You see, there's one with black set between 2 blue. And there's probably the most exotic of the lot, a block of 12 with diagonals and inverted diagonals in all sorts of different directions. And then there are a few carefully cut out with missing surcharges. I think they too came from the trial sheets. All but one or two of them are in the Royal Philatelic Collection, and I suspect were probably kept for the king, but I'm not sure. Why were so many colours used? Unless the ink ran out, I can think of no good reason, and with the presence of all types and colours in the fancy sheets, one can only conclude that either Wall, who was the Postmaster General, or the printer, had a good time producing stamps for their official friends, or perhaps for themselves to create a potentially valuable market. I really don't know. Now, there's some higher values. There's a shilling value, and there's no surviving contemporary report, oddly enough, of the quantity that were produced of these. My view is that in Violet, there must have been at least half a sheet with surcharges in setting A. That's with the N lined up over the two L's. And a sheet in setting B where the N lines up over the LI. In Vermilion, there must have been at least a sheet in setting B, but setting A as a single stamp only occurs, setting A only occurs in the mixed colour sheet, and as a single stamp, there is but one in Vermilion, and that's here, and that was probably cut from the mixed colour sheet, because most of them appear as pairs in Vermilion and Violet. As far as use is concerned, few stamps were used in setting A, very few indeed, and the majority of stamps in setting B are found cancelled. I didn't say used, I said cancelled. You can't really be entirely certain, of course, as to why they were used at all, because there wasn't a postal rate to justify it. Now, for less of a mystery than what I would describe as a deliberate hoax or fraud. This concerns the 27 black one-shilling surcharges with sloping serifs to the S. The lettering actually wanders all over the place, from being lined up over the L, slightly to the left of it, well to the right. I mean, unlike the last lot of one shillings I showed you, where it's either straight over the L or over the LI, these are all over the shop, as well as being a different font. And I frankly can't accept the different typeface was found for these few stamps and these alone. The setting A in black with upright serifs occurs in the mixed colour sheet, so we know that's likely to have been at least right in so far as those fancies were. With or without certificates, in my opinion, these sloping serif stamps are later forgeries. They are discussed at greater length in the supplement, and they are there referred to as the Perriman find. We then come to the 5- and 10-shilling stamps. These were either produced in much larger quantities than Perriman thought, or easier to forge than the other values. I'm going to have to leave that to your judgment, but I do warn you that there are some 10 shillings with a very thin vertical to the one, and I wouldn't buy those if I were you. The 9 20-shilling stamps have been known, each of them, in violet, in vermilion, and in black, since 1901, 1902, though the people writing about them have varied in defining how many of each. We now know there are 3 of each. I know where all but 2 are currently, although I think one of those 2 is still at Bear on offer. Certainly one of these stamps was sold in 1991, and the other, as I say, I think is still available. The 20-shilling stamps have their own mystery, however. Oh, by the way, there are the 3 colours, but they're illustrated there as well. They have their own mystery. You can reconstruct them. I put them together by their perforations, and Frank quite independently did the same thing, and we came to the same shape. The other thing that's strange about them, bearing in mind that they don't make a regular block, and you've got the violet ones there and the black ones there and the a bad reproduction, but those are 3 vermilion ones, is that they seem to have been produced in groups. The other thing, though, which is strange about them, is the 2s aren't all the same. There are only 9 stamps, but you've got one with a very thin, squared-off, vertical upright and thin at the top, one with a short, stubby, curved serif to the 2, and one with a rounded, thicker 2 altogether. I rather think that Sir Claude, or Claude MacDonald as he was at the time, said to the Postmaster General, Mr. Wall, could you get me another one for one of my friends, please? And out came the printing set again, and they made another. But they are very well-respected stamps in their own right, and every serious collector of these stamps has wanted to have one. Now, Perryman discusses why the higher values were produced at all. He started off by saying that they were needed for parcels, but then he changed his mind. He then said that they were used to write back the value that had been written down when tuppence and tuppence halfpenny stamps were written down to a halfpenny, and that there was a shortfall in the stock at the post office, and the balance was used to account for that. Now, this is all very well, but it depends. If you take his production figures seriously, then the write-down would have been... the write-up was £58, and the loss in value of the stock left over at the post office would have been £35. Now, in the currency of the time, that's going to be, what, 200-300 times as much today? There should have been a post office inquiry. There would have been a post office inquiry, and there isn't any record of a post office inquiry. So one reckons that probably there wasn't really that sort of loss in the post office to be accounted for. If Perryman's quantities of 5 shillings and 10 shillings were correct, the surplus should have been just over £12. Perhaps a small enough loss then to avoid an official inquiry. But anyway, it's either a case of producing them for your friends, or half the stamps are fakes, even though they've got good certificates. I don't know the answer to that, and I leave it to you to decide for yourselves. Another question is why, if there was a real shortage of halfpenny stamps, were so many used in these large multiples? You know, you needed a halfpenny stamp. Why did you put six of them together to make threepence? Now, Mr. Griffith justifies this by saying that he got short of other values too and had to use the provisionals to make up whatever the rate was. Well, perhaps he did, but he also addressed a lot of letters to a very small number of people, sometimes several on a day, and they carefully kept most of those covers. A final comment on the 1893 Old Calivar provisionals. Most of the surcharges are pretty coarse, and the lettering is rather variable in appearance, even when under-inked, with some of the lettering or the bar missing. On the other hand, a few stamps have clean and clear surcharges like that, usually lighter in colour, and this particularly applies to the blue colourway, but also to a few of the others. Beware of them, that's all I would say. No doubt many more stamps will turn up. I keep being given further examples, and I was given some more to look at today. Of the rarer stamps, one or two have been seen for the first time just recently, but I have so far not found either of the examples of Type 7 in Carmine, which Dick Agerbeg recorded. Those are the only stamps I haven't seen. Passing on to the Old Calabar provisionals, Griffith says that Tanner, who was responsible, had no printing press. So he hand-carved, first of all, two very small ones, and he didn't think they'd do, so he made a larger one. That's according to Griffith. If that was the case, one has to wonder where the halves came from, because I very much doubt that he hand-carved those. They don't look like hand-carving to me. But you'll see in the supplement there are an awful lot of varieties on both of these, different shapes, and it leaves a lot of unanswered questions. I honestly don't know what the real answer to that is. Incidentally, Robert Nelson, who's here today, very kindly provided me with a study of variable perforations on one of these stamps. It's the pale blue... The pale blue one up there, and I wrongly attributed it in the supplement to the last Old Calabar provisional. So it's possible that actually there are twice as many of those pale blue stamps, two sheets instead of one, that were produced, because he proves pretty good evidence that there were two sheets used. The final stamp, which is an Old Calabar provisional, that one, I've only found about 30% of the ones that were recorded as having been produced, which is rather nearer showing real commercial use. You've got this well-known broken RN producing an OI there, and you've got a lot of really rather spectacular double surcharges as well, or quite a lot. These are a stamp for which there seems to have been a greater demand. Now, just going towards the end, there are quite a lot of covers. I've seen 113 with surcharge stamps. These are three examples. Nearly half of these were sent by Griffith to various members of his family. In addition to the surcharge stamps, there were unsurcharged bisects. I've seen 54 covers and 28 pieces. All but two covers and 17 pieces used at Bonny were used on the last day authorised, September the 11th, 94. Mostly with very fancy combinations of bisects for stamps that were still available, otherwise those values. They also, interestingly, occur in long runs of registered mail, numbered. You can see the number there, 35, but they go through about 100 numbers in blocks addressed to the same address, not all to the same person. And they're also, in addition to being over 100 in that numbering sequence, there are 12 not registered covers. There are probably quite a lot more of those around. So there you've got that. Then finally, another issue is there are said to have been, Porter says there were CTOs. Well, there certainly are some very large quantities used on one or two dates, 129 at Fort Cardos, which wasn't even one of the ports that was supposed to have needed them on the 3rd of January. 51 at Old Calabar on the 16th of March. And there are also a number of stamps with a postmark before they were issued. Now, they're either predated CTOs or forgeries. I can't tell you which. There is a certain amount of dispute about the postmarks, too. Griffith says only the square cancellors were used on genuine mail and the little circular postmark only on whole uncut sheets. It's rubbish, because there are plenty of covers with little circular postmarks. On the other hand, MacDonald, who was the Consul General, makes the statement that he had abolished the square postmarks, and that's not true either. What are my conclusions? I think basically this is either a philatelist's dream or a nightmare, depending on where you come from. At least one can be a lot clearer today about how many sheets were produced, about the status of the black and blue-black halfpenny surcharges, and about the sloping one-shilling serifs. I was asked by Patrick, as I said, Patrick Pearson, how many do you think, John, that would otherwise or have been declared to be genuine or actually fakes? Well, from the stamps and the photographs I've seen, I can only tell you that I think about 5% are clearly wrong. Beyond that, I cannot go. I haven't got enough evidence. Ladies and gentlemen, that's what I can tell you about these interesting philatelic stamps. Anyway, they're an interesting issue, and I'll take any questions anybody wants to ask.
Thank you, John. I think he lived up to his advanced statement. That is fairly provocative. Certainly lots of questions, and I take it from the number of stamps you've got in your collection shows your faith in what you feel about them.
Well, I've got three or four covers I think are probably okay.
Right. I think that's perhaps one conclusion.
That isn't the reason. No, I don't collect stamps.
I know you don't, no. So if anybody's interested in that, if they could see Ellen on that. The other thing is to do an advance announcement of what's happening on the AGM day. The AGM will be at 5 o'clock as normal, but during the afternoon at 3 o'clock, we're going to be a special presentation about an IT project that details a full article, well, a page in the next LP will describe one exciting project that the Society is starting to develop, and we'd like to present on the afternoon of the AGM at 3 o'clock. Frank Walton and Chris King, who are spearheading this project, would like to do a presentation and then give some details and explanation about what they're working on. So if you are intending to come to the AGM that day, if you'd like to see that presentation, please be here by 3 o'clock. So it's advance notice, but the details will be in the LP. So after those two announcements, I'd like to thank John once again for an excellent and provocative display. I think he's certainly done that. And to say to everyone, close of the meeting, but wine and nibbles downstairs. Okay, thank you.